Good morning. You may be wondering who the other is in today's reflection, but I can't define that for you, because who the other is depends wholly on who you are. Do you identify as male, middle-aged? Perhaps you are indigenous, feminist, libertarian, polyamorous? Identity. It helps shape our psychology, because we humans are ultimately tribal in nature. I'll get to that in a moment. But despite our Unitarian ideal of being one people, we all naturally gravitate toward one or more identities that both give us a sense of belonging within a larger world and cause us to view those outside our tribes with suspicion. We've been hearing a lot about identity lately. I think I first heard about identity politics perhaps 5 years ago, and it was coming from critics on the right in the US. They complained that those who were champions of diversity were being divisive, and that groups such as women, people of color, and those in the LGBT community had essentially won hard-fought rights, but should now just integrate into the larger culture. Fast forward to 2019, when there is a right-wing president in the US, whom I would argue largely got elected based on identity politics. Because what is populism other than the attempt of politicians to appeal to people based largely on their identities? There seems to be a culture war going on in the US right now, and of course, as always, that spills over into Canadian politics too. What's more, I am very afraid of the trend of populism that's happening all over the world right now. Back to the idea that people are tribal in nature. I'm going to be talking today about people's cognitive biases and how these shape our discourse and why the discourse we experience in 2019 is becoming so polarized. But where do our cognitive biases and our tribal nature come from? Homo sapiens emerged in Africa about 315,000 years ago. Our brains continued to evolve for thousands of years in what has been coined the environment of evolutionary adaptation. This ancestral environment is not one particular place or time, but we can assume that the brains that we have inherited today have been shaped over hundreds of thousands of years. In other words, before agriculture, before cities, before human civilization. Our brains were shaped by an environment in which we lived as hunter-gatherers in kinship groups that typically numbered 30 to 50 in size. Having a strong sense of identity makes sense in a kinship group. Your very survival depended on forging close bonds with those in your group, and you would be very wary of anyone you encountered who was not part of your community because your survival depended on it. The other in that environment could literally mean your life was in danger. Today we live in a completely different world. The modern environment allows us to coexist peacefully with strangers, on some of whom we rely for our daily needs. And yet our brains are still optimized for life in those small kinship groups of the ancient past. But I'm going to present to you today how some of those adaptations lead us to make cognitive errors in our discourse in modern society, and how these errors are creating a toxic environment, what James Hogan calls the pollution of the public square. Excuse me. James Hogan is a PR specialist in Vancouver and the former chair of the David Suzuki Foundation. He has written a book called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, where he states that, quote, the most pressing problem we face today may not be climate change, but the pollution of the public square. And that, quote, polarization is stifling discussion and debate, creating resistance to change and thwarting our ability to solve our collective problems. Whether the public space be a street corner, a blog, a political meeting, a water cooler, or even a church basement, we are becoming a society where public discourse is becoming more challenging and where beliefs are becoming more polarized. I'd also argue that there is a coarsening of discussion. A coarsening of discussion that originates in the online world. On Twitter, for example, when you only have 280 characters to make your point, it seems people often just cut to the chase and engage in name-calling instead of reasoned debate. We are also living in what is being called a post-truth era, where media outlets are increasingly treated with skepticism and politicians are claiming alternative facts. Is it just me, or is it becoming increasingly difficult to live out our fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning? When the public square is tainted with lies, insults, and extremism, is it any wonder so many people give up on reasoned discussion and just hunker down in their ideological foxholes? But the great philosopher John Stuart Mill argued, "He who only knows his own side of the case knows little of that." In other words, Mill believed that it was important to engage with people who held different views, because it strengthened one's own understanding of the truth. In his book, James Hogan illustrates his points mainly by using the issue of climate change and trying to understand how, despite clear scientific consensus on the issue, so many people continue to resist doing much about it or even deny its validity. But it was his recent interview on CBC about the resistance of some parents to vaccinate against measles that caught my attention. In order to solve our collective problems, be it climate change, disease, poverty, or globalization, we need to be able to engage in more reasoned discussions than we are currently having. What's getting in the way? Hogan explores another phenomenon polluting the public square. It is called the advocacy trap, and it goes something like this. When people disagree with us, we start out by questioning their views. Eventually, though, we question their motives and intentions. If they continue to push back against our thinking, we begin to view them as aggressors. We become defensive, feel offended, and get angry. Eventually, we may not just see them as wrong, but as wrongdoers, even enemies. Hogan's book describes how important social justice leaders like Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi refused to fall into the advocacy trap. They refused to allow the behavior or attitudes of others to determine their own attitudes. But this kind of response in the face of opposition takes conscious thought and discipline, because our natural inclination is to paint those who repeatedly disagree with us as foes. He urges advocates to abandon this mental trap and instead hold every person in their vision with respect. He suggests that if you are religious, you could tell yourself that they too are a child of God. Or a more humanist response might be, I don't know what childhood experiences that person had that led them to behave like this. But in order to communicate more effectively, it is important to start by assuming that others' intentions are good. Hogan interviews social psychologist Carol Tavris, who co-authored Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. Tavris highlights a few cognitive processes that get in the way of reasoned dialogue. First, she talks about confirmation bias, which is our tendency to seek out and pay attention to information we already agree with and to ignore or dismiss information that is contradictory to our held belief. For example, if a person believes in astrology, he will read his horoscope today, and everything in it to which he can make a personal connection will reinforce his faith in astrology. Any information that is clearly not about him, though, will probably not make him rethink his belief in horoscopes. He'll just minimize this contradiction with, it's not a perfect system, but it mostly gets things right. You can see how confirmation bias can help keep groups separate. Those who believe in climate science, for example, will eagerly, if unhappily, accept new reports that climate change is happening even more quickly than previously thought, while a so-called climate skeptic might just say, the media just can't be trusted on this issue. Next, Tavris talks about the role of cognitive dissonance, which can be defined as the mental stress that is caused when a person holds two or more contradictory beliefs. A common example is that of the smoker. In order to reduce the psychological tension involved in this contradictory act, a person will find ways to minimize the harm involved, such as by reminding herself that her grandfather smoked his whole life and lived to 90, or hopefully by quitting altogether. Taver suggests that cognitive dissonance helps keep us committed to our beliefs, especially beliefs that we have acknowledged publicly, or that we have invested our heart in, or that we have invested time, effort, and money into maintaining. For example, I'd predict that a person who placed a liberal sign on his lawn during the last federal election is probably less likely to switch his vote to the Conservative Party come October than a person who just privately voted for her liberal candidate. It is a third idea that Tavris presents, however, that I found most intriguing. She calls it the pyramid of choice and describes it like this. Two young men, and this sketch is actually by somebody else, so imagine two people at the top. Two young men who are identical in terms of attitudes, abilities, and psychological health are standing at the top of a pyramid. They are pals, and they are undecided about some issue. Cheat or don't cheat in an exam, buy this car or that, take drug company money for their research or not. Now, one of them makes a decision in one direction, and the other makes a decision in the opposite direction. The minute they do that, they both start looking for evidence to confirm the wisdom of their choices. As they justify their decisions and their beliefs, they each begin moving farther and farther away from each other until, over time, they are standing at the bottom of the same pyramid, miles apart, and they might have come to dislike or even despise each other. Over time, these individuals who begin in a state of indecision are now completely entrenched in the correctness of their own stance on the issue. The original decision may not even have been that well thought out, but the result of justifying it over and over is that it becomes much harder to go back up that pyramid and change their minds. This is called the justification of effort phenomenon. The harder you push back against a person ideologically, the less likely she is to change her mind. If you call a person on the other side of the debate an idiot, you make it far less likely for her to re-examine her beliefs, and instead make it more likely for her to re-justify the beliefs, further entrenching her in her original position. Hogan also interviewed Yale philosophy and epistemology professor Jason Stanley, who suggested that part of the reason our public square has become polluted is that there are those in ideological camps who steal the voices of others in very deliberate ways. He uses as an example the way that some tried to discredit Barack Obama by claiming that he was an Islamist or born in Kenya, when neither of these things are true. Despite Obama refuting these claims, there were still those who believed them and found everything he said suspect. It's kind of like the old adage, when did you stop beating your spouse? Once your voice has been stolen, for some, nothing you say will have any effect in changing their minds. Stanley suggests that one way that right-wing media outlet Fox News has manipulated its audience is through the claim that it is, quote, fair and balanced. Maybe Fox News had no intention of actually suggesting that they are in fact fair and balanced, because its audience would be able to see its bias. Instead, he suggests, they were making the suggestion that no media can be fair and biased, and that all news is essentially propaganda. Perhaps you are better to pay attention to the media outlet that gets it, instead of other media that still pretends to be neutral, according to this narrative. It's an interesting idea. I don't know if I quite buy it, but. For some today, truth is the position you choose to believe rather than any state of reality. It can be very challenging to hold discourse with people who just move the goalposts in an argument or refute factual information by simply refusing to believe it because it comes from the wrong sources. So where to go from here? You are now aware of some ways your own thinking might not always be completely rational, but how to bridge differences when the other, whoever that might be in your situation, is also prone to making so many cognitive errors. Here's what religious historian Karen Armstrong suggested to Hogan. Compassion. She cites Confucius as perhaps the first person to formulate the golden rule. Apparently, his disciples asked him which of his teachings could be put into practice all day, every day. His response was shu, the act of looking into your own heart to find what gives you pain, and then refusing under any circumstances whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. When Confucius was asked about how to apply this in political life, his response was that when among the common people, you must behave as though you were in the presence of an important guest. Sounds a lot like the idea about treating every person like a child of God. Armstrong adds that while it is important to speak out about injustice, you must at the same time ask yourself about your motivations. Are your actions about your ego and punishing your opponent, or are they about real change? Because if you come from an antagonistic, egotistical position, people will double down and resist what you are trying to achieve. This month, our theme is curiosity. I think approaching the other from a position of respect, using the ability to acknowledge their legitimate concerns, and maintaining a stance of curiosity rather than judgment will go a long way in opening up discussion. I'm going to leave you with an example of a person who has decided to do just that. Sarah Silverman is an edgy stand-up comic who has become increasingly political over the years. She was a big Bernie supporter and spoke at the 2016 Democratic National Convention on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Lately, she has been using her social media presence to reach out to people across the political aisle. Silverman posted a tweet reaching out to Trump supporters, and a man named Jeremy responded by calling her the C word. Silverman's response to him was quite extraordinary. She said, "I believe in you. I read your timeline and I see what you're doing, and your rage is thinly veiled pain. But you know that. I know this feeling. P.S. My back sucks too. See what happens when you choose love. I see it in you." Jeremy responded that he could not choose love, implying that he had been molested and that this was where his anger stemmed from. Thus ensued a back and forth that ended up with people reaching out to Jeremy, and eventually Silverman helped to find him counseling. David Weissman, a self-described former Twitter troll, has recently opened up about another exchange between Silverman and himself. And this audio comes from CBC's Out in the Open, and I apologize, it's not great audio, but hopefully we'll be able to understand it.
If you've been on Twitter for more than about a minute, you know what a toxic, mean-spirited place it can be. But sometimes things like this happen.
David Weissman writes, "At Sarah K. Silverman, I'm trying hard to understand why you guys support people who enter the country illegally more than vets. My followers say for votes, but I really want to hear it from the left. Why care more about illegals than American people?"
Sarah Silverman writes, "It's not more than. That's an odd twist to put on it. This is a country of immigrants. Our greatness comes from our inclusion. These people pay taxes, serve in our military. They're not other, they are us. You come from immigrants, David. We all do. Heart emoji."
At Sarah K. Silverman, "I see liberals blame the NRA. Can you provide me proof why the NRA is to blame? Their mission is to protect the Second Amendment." "Hey, at Sarah K. Silverman, you are one of the few liberals I really trust, especially how you care for people. Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate you and your followers helping me understand a little bit more about Planned Parenthood and abortion. I know it's a tough subject, but I have a better understanding." Sarah, you are changing my view of liberals.
Dave and I became friends on Twitter even though, or maybe because, we're so different politically. He loves Trump. I feel very much the opposite. We found out we're more alike than we thought. I have a hunch if people turn their vitriol into discourse, we all would.
This completely changed his politics in the aftermath of this respectful discourse, and he credits Sarah Silverman for helping him to change his online behavior. Confucius, Gandhi, King, and now Silverman? She'd probably take issue with being placed alongside of history's greatest moral leaders. However, She shows us that any of us can aspire to do better in our relationships with the other, whomever that might be for us.